Welcome to the latest edition of the Conversation Democracy 2025 podcast on political trust in times of COVID-19, produced by the Content Group. This is Mark Evans, Director of Democracy 2025, and the co-host of this podcast series with Michelle Grattan. Now, this afternoon, we're in conversation with two award-winning public servants, Peter Sheargold and Rennie Leon, addressing the question, what role will the APS need to play in a post-COVID-19 world? Now, most Australians are probably unaware how highly thought of the Australian Public Service is in international terms. It's currently ranked fifth in the International Civil Service Effectiveness Index, second in both the Euro Monitor's Digital Connectivity Index and the United Nations E-Government Development Index, and it's ranked in the top 10 countries overall by the World Bank for the quality of its governance. Yet despite its international reputation, it has been accused by successive governments of failing to provide strategic policy advice, deliver high quality services, build effective collaborative governance, both whole of government and with states, territories and other sectors, and indeed keep up with modern business practices. And recommendations to address these issues can be found in both the 2010 Reform of Government Administration, which was termed the Moran Review, and the recent 2019 Australian Public Service Review, led by David Thodey. But for many politicians, progress has been too slow. At the same time, academics and political commentators alike believe that the traditional role of the independent APS in the Westminster system has been profoundly challenged by the politicisation of senior appointments and the Secretary's Board. This is the leadership group of the Australian Public Service. And also the inability of the APS to forge its own identity in an era of hyper-partisanship. Now, the value and quality of the work of the Australian Public Service has been in plain sight and in sharp focus in the management of both the bushfires and COVID-19. And trust in federal government has now reached its highest level since the heyday of the Howard era. So has the role of the APS in the Westminster system fundamentally changed over the past two decades? Will COVID-19 be the disruptive event that leads to the transformation of the APS, akin to the global financial crisis and its impact on New Zealand's central government? I mean, the New Zealand case is a great success story in this regard. Deep-seated cuts in the wake of the double whammy of the global financial crisis and the Canterbury earthquake led to several major public sector reforms. The establishment of 10 shared priority outcomes to stimulate cross-agency collaboration with chief executives jointly accountable with the relevant ministers. The creation of flatter, more agile agencies led by chief executives with twin responsibilities to their minister and also as stewards of the public interest. Whole of government data integration and procurement and outcomes-driven reform in the design and delivery of public service. So could this be a New Zealand moment for the Australian Public Service? What role will the APS need to play in a post-COVID-19 world? So to help us with these questions and much more, we're delighted to be in conversation with two outstanding former public servants. Former head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, National President of the Institute of Public Administration Australia and current Chancellor of Western Sydney University, Peter Sheargold, and the last Secretary of the Department of Human Services, Public Service Medalist and former Deputy Secretary in both the Attorney General's Department and the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, Rennie Leon. Many thanks to you both for joining us this afternoon. Rennie, let me start with you. Do you think government criticism of the APS has been fair?
Hello, Mark. It's great to be part of the podcast. I think the idea that government can criticise the public service without recognising how the public service is a creature of the government and what it wants is the part that's unfair. So, for example, public service is regularly criticised, including by the government, for being risk averse. But of course, we're serving ministers who absolutely want risk to be avoided if it's going to result in public criticism or scrutiny. And we're implementing policies and systems to the extent that the government's prepared to decide on them and fund them. So it's certainly true, as Thodey and others have said, that the public service is operating with woefully old systems that have made it difficult to deliver the kind of 21st century services that people expect. But you can't build a brand new digital system if the government won't invest in it. And government, for many years now, has thought that IT systems are a tedious waste of money and not nearly as good to announce as something that the punters can touch and feel. So I think the government gets what it asks for from the public service. And if they want a more nimble, flexible, take a few risks public service, then as ministers, they have to be prepared to front up to the possibility that things won't go perfectly.
So I do think
there's criticism about too much hierarchy. I think that is fair, and that we ought to be able, as a public service, to make ourselves organisationally more nimble. And certainly in my old department, we were operating large swathes of it using agile squads rather than the more traditional hierarchy. But it's not widespread in the public service, and it could be more so.
So there's really been little tolerance for risk taking at a time when, you know, the big public policy transformative agendas that we need to respond to require risk taking. Peter, your thoughts?
I agree with a great deal that Rene said. No, I think the attack on the Australian public services generally, is often wide of the mark, and the global rankings do show that. I think in terms of, you know, efficiency and effectiveness and organisational capability and frankly, whole of government approaches, we're in good shape. I do agree strongly with Rene. I think that there has been, at least within the Australian public service, an unexpected return to hierarchical controls. You know, for a lot of my time in the public service, all the managerial ease was about teamwork. And that does concern me. I mean, it's great to talk about speaking truth to power. And of course, I believe that secretaries and director generals should speak truth to power when they talk to ministers confidentially. But I also think it's important that middle managers are able to speak truth to power as well. And yet I've seen a lot of return of slow bureaucratic processes. I do think you are both right also, if we compare ourselves with New Zealand. I think part of what is expected from an Australian public service, part of the extent to which it can manage risks, depends on the government it serves. In New Zealand, I think you have to say you've had a number of prime ministers and treasurers who have been very committed and understanding about the role of public services and been very outspoken about the sort of public service they want, have been authorising. The role I do in New South Wales at the moment as Coordinator General for Refugee Resettlement, I'm very lucky because Mike Baird, of course, created that position. Gladys Berejiklian's been very supportive. And essentially, I've been given all the authority I need to try to do things in very different ways in collaboration and partnership with civil society organisations. But it wouldn't have been possible without that government authority.
So there's a real need for sort of strategic, political, bureaucratic alignment and sort of a common vision of change. But Peter, do you think that the APS has or is losing its independence and cultural authority in the Australian political system?
I am impressed by the way that all the public services that I have worked with, including the APS, retain that underlying traditional ethos of Westminster democracy. I think most public servants still profoundly believe in serving successive governments with equal commitment, being apolitical, being non-partisan, impartial, all of that. I think, however, public services worry a great deal that that important ethos is being undermined. When I was the national president of IPA, I did a survey of public servants, both Commonwealth and state, and it was clear that there were concerns about two things in particular. About the role being played by ministerial advisors in our system of democratic governance. And the second was the increasing extent to which governments look to external consultants to undertake a great deal of their advice.
So the role of consultancies is in many ways another form of outsourcing advice, isn't it? And that potentially undermines the role of departments. René, did you feel that your fundamental role as a secretary was undermined by the politics that you confronted, or did you feel you were able to discharge your independent role?
I certainly, as Peter says, feel that the public service, including me, were very clear about what the appropriate role is for a public servant, that we are there to give independent and impartial advice, and that we loyally serve and respond to the agenda of the government of the day. And I've never felt there was any doubt about that. I think that different ministers have less understanding or more understanding of what that means. And there's certainly, I think, an increasing number of ministers these days who think that independent advice from the public service is some kind of affront if it's not what the minister had already asked for in terms of what the outcome should be. So I think that some ministers haven't understood that it's perfectly all right for them to get advice from the public service and disagree with it, but they ought to get the advice. They ought to be informed by the enormous amount of expertise that there is in the public service. Unfortunately, one of the reasons why matters have moved up and up the chain is because of the pressure that is put on middle managers to change their advice so that the minister will agree with it. And, of course, you can't expect people below the SES to be able confidently to resist the insistence of a ministerial advisor. And so decision-making and clearance keeps moving up to people who are going to have the intestinal fortitude and the risk-taking to be able to stand their ground against the effort to press back against independent and impartial advice. So I think there's a lot of risk to the role and the authority of the public service when those practices occur, but I don't think the public service is in any doubt about what its role is. None of us would mind, and in fact, the public service should do more of getting views from outside. I just think most of us think that going to a consultant and thinking that you're going to get the magic answer is more a testament to the wonders of the marketing of consultants than it is to the greatness of the product they produce.
I think René is right. I think in some ways, Mark, public servants have been their own worst enemy in this regard. I still see public services operate as if there is an A group of public servants, the creme de la creme, and they're the ones who provide a confidential policy advice to ministers. And then there's the B group, who are the people who actually go out and deliver public policy. And so that leads a prime minister to say, quite rightly, I want to see a public service which is much more focused on citizens, on customers, and is service focused and delivery, and not to worry about the design and development of policy. Now, the fact is, the design of policy and the delivery of policy go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. You can only judge how good a policy is by the way in which it's delivered. And I think, in a sense, by making that demarcation as if they are two different areas of public sector endeavour, that we have helped to make it so that a minister can think, well, I can talk to my party room, I can talk to my colleagues, I can talk to my advisors, I can talk to consultants about the design of policy, and then I'll just get my public servants to deliver it. It's a nonsense, but is not sufficiently recognised as a nonsense.
So I guess that's at the heart of your clarion call. I remember in the speech you made to IPA in 2016, Peter, where you emphasised the importance of creating a culture of continuous learning. And I guess continuous learning is about getting better integration between policy, programmes and service systems. So you're getting, better, a virtuous cycle between, you know, innovation on the front line being passed back to policy and leading to a strengthening of the policy system. So is the way forward for you here the creation of that culture of continuous learning?
Yes, it is, but it's in a much bigger context, I think, Mark, of trying to reimagine what public service looks like in the 2020s and going forward. And again, when I'm talking about the development and design of policy, I'm increasingly of the view that that isn't just something that public servants do. Public servants have a situational authority that can help to harness the public sector, the private sector, the university, civil society organisations, frontline deliverers, all to come together in the design of the policy which meets the objectives that governments have set.
Thanks, Peter. So Michelle now has some questions for you both around the impact of COVID-19. But that sort of inclusive approach to policy design is really at the heart of the number of questions we'll be putting to you. Michelle.
I wonder if we can start with the views of both of you on the extent to which you think the pandemic will be the sort of disruptive event that leads to some fundamental transformation of the public service akin to what Mark was talking about earlier with New Zealand and the global financial crisis, or will we, using the fashionable language, just see a snapback to things as we've known them?
So I think much depends on what it is that the government authorises going forward. So the public service has responded well to COVID-19 and demonstrated the kind of flexibility and strategic ability and cross-jurisdictional and cross-departmental collaboration that those of us who've been in it for a long time know it's perfectly capable of delivering. But in normal times, the incentives for public servants are very much on the vertical. What does your own minister want? And unless government sets a whole of government set of priorities, as New Zealand did, and then liberated the public service to come up with the best ways of achieving them, then we will, of course, revert back to each department is just doing whatever the latest thing is that their minister wants. So much of this depends on the authorising environment. The public service is perfectly capable of pulling together task forces and working across boundaries to achieve priorities that are set by the government. But we've had a bit of a vacuum of whole of government priority setting for quite some time. And so people will necessarily work to the vertical and deliver what their own minister wants, which won't necessarily be the joined up united front that we've seen in relation to COVID-19.
I think that's right, Michelle. And I think I've been thinking about this a great deal. Will this really make a medium to long-term difference? I know that you, at least, will, like me, have a memory that goes back to the Asian tsunami of 2004. An absolutely tragic crisis began on a Boxing Day, and yet the extraordinary opportunity that that represented to do things fast, which were inconceivable only a few weeks earlier. So if you may remember, not only did we respond well to the immediate crisis, But within 8 days, the Prime Minister, John Howard, was able to go and announce the biggest single aid package, the Australia-Indonesia Partnership for Reconstruction and Development, that had ever been made. It was inconceivable. It was that classic instance of grabbing a crisis and doing things politically you couldn't do before. Now, I'm quite excited by what has come out of the tragedies and the crises, both initially of the bushfires and of now, of course, of the pandemic, both the health crisis and, of course, the economic crisis. It does create, I think, in Australia, a sense of solidarity, although hopefully a solidarity which realises that we're all doing it at different levels of toughness, and we've really got to address the disadvantage that is created. But also, I think it gives a sense of the importance of expertise. I mean, what has been great is in both of these crises to see that the government clearly, in a way, deferring to the expertise of emergency service leaders and public health advisors, and of course, the frontline role of teachers and nurses and doctors. It does, in a sense, convey to the public both a sense of the importance of expertise, and more than that, that a great source of that expertise sits within public service. So it seems to me that there is a basis there on which to build. Now, will it happen? Will it happen once the immediate crisis is over? And that's what's much harder, I think, to predict.
In a way, I guess what a crisis like this does, and where the experts are so necessary, is give a government a reality check that it doesn't actually know everything, which one had the impression before it thought it did.
I think that's right. And that at a time of crisis like this, where you've got to do things on a large scale and very fast and on the basis of a level of expertise, ministerial advisors can play a very, very important role. Consultancy firms can, but you need the strength which exists within public administration. And I think people are making international comparisons now, not just with Europe, but particularly, you know, the United States, admittedly a Washingtonian system of a democracy, but where it's increasingly obvious that for all of that amazing health and medical expertise that exists in the United States, that the public health systems in most states are at an abjectly poor level.
Renee, it's interesting, isn't it, that this crisis has made some officials public figures. For example, in particular, federally, we've seen the chief medical officer and his deputies out there day after day with the Prime Minister by themselves briefing the public on the latest developments in the crisis.
I think it's been a really good development, the way that we are seeing experts being listened to and relied upon. And it is the one thing that I hope most of all will survive the crisis, because we have seen really an attack on expertise in the last decade, where to be an expert was almost to be reviled for being part of the elites, and people were sick of experts, and the government certainly was sick of experts with all their pesky evidence and so on that wasn't necessarily in alignment with their more favoured decision-making input, which is anecdote. So I am very hopeful that realisation that expertise is worth something will endure after the disruption of the pandemic. But it is pretty deep-seated, the rejection of expertise, and certainly the rejection of the idea that public servants should have an independent voice has been very thorough over the past at least a decade. And as a secretary, I certainly would not have had any authority to go out and say anything publicly about either what the labour market information update meant, even though my department produced it, and I certainly wouldn't have been able to go out and say anything publicly about the challenges to better service delivery when I was the Secretary of Human Services, unless all of that content had been thoroughly cleared by the Minister's office. And if I had something to say that was factual, but that was politically inconvenient, there certainly wouldn't have been any public place for that level of expert input. So if we're going to be able to have experts actually say what they think is happening with the economy or with the labour market or with the health system, I think that would be a great development that would both mean the public could know that they were getting information from people with no axe to grind, but just actual facts would be a really good thing to increase trust in the public service and in government and to increase the quality of our government.
Well, one interesting thing, of course, is that Brendan Murphy, the chief medical officer that we're seeing so much of, is actually going to be the next secretary of the health department when he gets past his present commitment. So whether he then retreats into a shell or not will be closely watched. Peter, do you think that the public services response to COVID has been overall fit for purpose, particularly in the context of this balance between services, providing services and providing advice?
Yes, I think, Michelle, at this initial stage, it has been fit for purpose. I can tell you because I'm the chair of a major aged care company with 76 residential aged care homes that, you know, behind the scenes, there's been a lot of hiccups and things going wrong and even buck passing and so on. But on the whole, because of the sense and the immediacy of the crisis, those have been resolved often by people at all sorts of levels showing a great deal of emotional intelligence and finding workarounds and get through things, which is what public servants should be good at. However, what we know from experience is after that immediate crisis, does that sense of adrenaline and purpose survive? You know, the response, I think, the immediate response to the bushfires was a remarkable testimony, again, to public servants. But if you look at, for example, now being payments made for people who suffered drought or bushfire, you get the sense that it's, in a sense, reverting back to type with lots of slowness and delay and so on. So that's the crisis. Can we capture this sense out of the crisis for good? And I think public servants also need to be clear on this. It's great that I think people are now recognizing the importance of what public servants do. And I don't just mean health advisors, I mean, you know, teachers in the classroom. But I don't think public servants should think, isn't it great now people realize that the public services are important. It's important for public servants to realize that they and governments are not the only people creating beneficial public impact. A lot of this response comes from harnessing the expertise and the experience of civil society organisations and university research and private sector experience, so that the public servants shouldn't revert to thinking, is this great, now people know how great public servants are. No, what we need to do is say public servants now have that capacity to facilitate and collaborate across sectors to create a public impact.
One of the interesting things in this crisis has been that it's put front and centre both the service delivery arm of the public service and the advisory central department arm, hasn't it? I wonder if each of you could comment, maybe Renee on the service delivery side and Peter on the central department side, especially bringing Treasury back into the spotlight. I think in recent years it has been less influential. Now we know it was at the absolute centre of the crafting of the wage support package. Renee, could you start?
So I am, of course, really delighted to see government and the rest of the public service recognising the importance of service delivery, because it always was something that the Service Delivery Department of Human Services was constantly trying to get recognised. As Peter said before, you can't really design a policy without thinking about how it's going to be delivered. And I know that might seem obvious, but it was very hard to get that accepted within the public service. And I might note that while we are seeing service delivery being recognised for its importance, it was only a few months ago that the secretary responsible for service delivery, the position was abolished so that the service delivery arm no longer has a voice at the secretary's board. So it has been demoted in any event, even though now it turns out to be one of the most critical functions that government's very dependent upon. What I think has been remarkable, of course, is the speed with which the service delivery arm of government has been able to respond to the crisis. But the reverting to type and things taking too long is not because public servants kind of go back and put their feet up on the table. I imagine that the reason that things are being done so quickly now is that it's all being done on a "we trust you and we'll worry about checking if this is right later" basis. And that way you can pay quickly and not worry if some of it might not, in fact, be correct. There just isn't the tolerance for that to be the normal approach. Centrelink could process social security claims extremely quickly if everyone was happy to just not worry about checking on the accuracy of them.
It's a good point. And Peter, what about the central departments and especially Treasury?
I believe that it is impossible for me to conceive that you can get good development of policy without having both the central agencies, PM&C and Treasury and Finance, working together and working with the line agencies. One of the things, as you probably remember, Michelle, that used to most irritate me when I was in PM&C was a view that in the good old days, 25 years ago, you know, secretaries really were secretaries and were willing to stand up to ministers, you know, unlike in the start of this century. When I did, as an economic historian, a bit of work on that, of course, what you discovered, that most of those secretaries were really in, you know, great territorial protectors of their own turf. And my own view is one of the ways that the Australian Public Service did improve during my time there was a greater sense of whole of government and collaboration. And PM&C and Treasury need to be absolutely at the centre of that. I cannot conceive that we would have made such progress on developing welfare reform. We could certainly have not developed an emission trading scheme, which was, of course, accepted by government, but then never implemented. But we couldn't have done either of those things without having PM&C and Treasury shoulder to shoulder and then calling on the expertise that sat in the line agencies.
One of the interesting things, of course, in this crisis has been the role of the head of Treasury, Stephen Kennedy. And if you think back, of course, to the GFC, you had Ken Henry absolutely at the centre of the policy response. Can I move on, though, to the end of this section of questions, the issue of trust? We've seen in various surveys renewed trust in government. Do you think, and government widely, both political and bureaucratic, do you think that this will break this cycle of distrust, or do you think this will be short-lived? Renee, what are your thoughts?
I think the reasons we're seeing renewed trust in government is because government is being regularly consultative, providing regular updates of information, explaining their reasons, and using experts to explain the situation and the response to it. And trust in government could certainly continue if those habits continued. But if we were to revert to the way in which government's mostly been conducted in recent times, where we get slogans and sound bites and not very much explanation, then of course people don't really warm to that. And so, as we said at the beginning, it's a really good opportunity for a reset, but it will depend on the continuation of the practices that have led to the increased trust.
What do you think, Peter?
I think the key problem here, if I may say so, isn't, you know, trust in public services or public servants. Public servants already have about twice the level of trust of the ministers and the governments that they serve. I remember looking at the last Roy Morgan poll on of the professions, and I think trust in Commonwealth and state politicians was running at about 16% and trust in public servants at about 32 to 34%. And of course, if you then ask about trust levels in teachers, doctors, nurses and police, all of whom are predominantly public sector roles, the levels of trust are in their 60s and 70s. I think the key issue we face, Michelle, and it worries me profoundly, is a declining trust in democratic governance, particularly amongst the young. A view that governments, we could do it with a bit more, you know, strong leadership. If only the Chinese had been building the George Street light rail, it would have been done in 6 months. And why can't we have that? And I think we need to reestablish that sense of democratic purpose, particularly amongst young Australians. And that means governments and their public services, I think, working far more together. Because otherwise we have a major issue. I think we've got to move away from last century's representative democracy to a much more participatory democracy. People aren't on the whole joining political parties anymore or going to party meetings or attending town hall meetings, etc. We need to find new ways of engaging citizens in the creation of public policy and allowing them to have influence. And that, I think, is a real challenge. You know, 30 years ago, we remember that Francis Fukuyama thought we'd come to the end of history, that, you know, liberal democratic values had won the global battle. I think now we look around the world and we sort of see this, you know, techno-authoritarianism re-emerging. And it's a real challenge for democracy, on Australian democracy. And I think governments and parliaments and judiciaries and public services have to work together.
Might hand over to Mark to dig a bit deeper into this issue.
Well, I think Peter put it very well there, the view that we need more participatory reforms to make the representative system of government more robust. And we know from the surveys that we've been doing with young Australians at the Museum of Australian Democracy that that's certainly something that they want to see. They want to see a more responsive, participatory politics that cares about the issues that they care about. But let me bring us back to this issue of public service reform. Renee, given that many of the FODE recommendations appear to have been kicked into the high grass, what do you think we can expect in terms of the reform of the APS over the next period?
Well, FODE did envisage a much more substantial reboot and transformation than I think we're going to see. But I think that the Public Service Commissioner will, subject to what happens to everyone after the coronavirus, of course, and what new priorities there are, but certainly when I finished up in the public service, there was a clear appetite for the Public Service Commission to be doing more, investing in capability and enabling mobility and prioritising the development of the kind of skills, for example, in personnel management and in digital skills that FODE had highlighted. But the more ambitious recommendations they didn't have the support of the government and they won't go anywhere. So we will see, a bit more flexibility, a bit more collaboration, a bit more investment in capability, but we won't be seeing the kind of very citizen-focused, co-designed, digitally oriented public service that I think Thodey envisaged we could have if his recommendations were accepted.
Isn't Services Australia supposed to be delivering that sort of mission? It looks from the outside, at least, to be a more decentralized approach. They talk a lot about user design. They talk a lot about subsidiarity. Or is there a gap between the rhetoric and the reality of what will recur?
So as Secretary of Human Services, we were already doing extensive co-design as we implemented the new welfare system, but there's no co-design going on with the policy that drives it. And that's what most of the frustrations arise from. So until you get co-design at the policy end, the service delivery end can only really implement whatever complex mishmash has come down the pipe from policy. And you can tinker with it a little bit in co-design, and we did a lot of co-design, but really you need to have that happen at the design point. For example, the new childcare subsidy, we can implement it in co-design so that we make sure that the words we use on the web page are ones that parents will understand. But we have no way of influencing the fact that there are 43 different eligibility criteria, and that's going to make applying for it complicated and confusing. That's all been set at the policy stage.
So that's a classic example of the disconnection of policy from delivery that Peter referred to before. So look, Peter, obviously given your huge experience working with the community sector, from the time that you stepped down from your role as head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, we seem to be entering a period of quite significant economic stress, where the potential for social exclusion could increase quite significantly. What would you like to see in terms of the type of collaborative arrangements that could make a difference in affecting the problem of increased marginalisation?
I think the way to do it is almost on a case-by-case, policy-by-policy arrangement, so that by all means senior public servants give confidential advice to governments and accept that governments are elected with their own mandates and their own policies. But then convince governments that the best way to do this, if you want to be bold, if you want to move fast, then actually do it on the basis of co-design, using the experience that exists in the private sector or the not-for-profit sector and so on. And I think one of the things we have to do is to convince governments you don't have to sit behind the scenes and design a policy, take it to cabinet, and announce it, and then have the public servants deliver it directly or under contract, and do it at a state or national level. No, this is a great opportunity to, once we know the directions the government wants to do, let's do things differently. It might be done differently in Western Sydney than in Wagga Wagga. So let's use trials and pilots and demonstrate, be willing to manage risk. What we don't want is another, a home insulation program where you roll something out nationally without doing all that risk management and start. Move quickly, trial things, adapt. If it's failing, fail quickly and stop. If it looks like it's being successful, then continue to learn and then scale up. If we could do more to convince governments to allow us to trial different approaches in different places to meet the goals of government, I think we would get much better public policy. And in my view, it should be public servants who are at the centre of coordinating and stewarding and facilitating that.
So the importance of experimentation, try, test and learn. But of course,
absolutely,
that requires the toleration of failure as well, doesn't it? So Michelle, over to you for a final set of questions.
Peter, can I explore this concept of public servants becoming more public, a proposition that Dennis Richardson, who is a retired, much-respected public servant with very extensive experience in the foreign affairs, defence, security areas, he was advocating this. If you are a very senior public servant and you make speeches from time to time, how do you cope with that? Where is the line between saying things you believe, advocating things indeed, and just reflecting the government's position? Can you do the former, or do you have to mainly stick to the latter?
My view is that public servants, and certainly once I was Secretary of PM&C, have a key role in speaking out publicly about the role of public servants. You need to do that in order to create a sense of identity and enthusiasm and commitment within the public service, but you need to do so on the basis that much you will say, either indirectly or directly, will become public. And honestly, I never had a problem on talking about the issues of public service. When it comes to the issues of public policy, I think it is vital that if you're going to be able to speak truth to power, you need to do so with ministers and prime ministers who understand that the advice and the arguments you'll have with them will remain confidential. And I must say, when it came to public policies, I always, whatever I had argued behind the scenes, and I would keep arguing until I was convinced government was making its decisions with eyes wide open. But once that was the case, and they had made a decision, whether I thought it was good, bad, or indifferent, I would then take a pride in the media and Parliament having no idea from the way I delivered that policy what I had actually argued in confidence. So yes, be public on the importance of public service, but in terms of your job, in terms of that confidential giving policy advice, I think that should stay between you and the minister.
Rene, all the textbooks, of course, talk about public servants giving frank and fearless advice. That's what they're supposed to do. But in practice, what is it like? Are there times when, as a senior public servant, you've felt this is just a bridge too far to give frank and fearless advice when I know the minister is absolutely set on something else, doesn't want to hear it, it's just too hard? Have you ever felt like that?
Well, I think you have to pick your battles on these things. I mean, if the minister's proposing to do something unlawful, then you really do have to get into the trenches and ensure that your advice has been heard. If the minister's proposing to do something that you really think there'd be a better way to achieve it, but they've heard that and they don't agree with you, well, then there's no point labouring the point. If you've given them the advice and they just disagree with you, then, as Peter says, they are the democratically elected government. I think it is more difficult to give frank and fearless advice to some ministers than to others. There undoubtedly are ministers who are perfectly aware of the important role of the public service and the importance of hearing the advice, even if you don't agree with it. And there are others who see it as an affront to their ego if you don't agree with them all the time. And of course, they are much more difficult to work with because of the fear that you'll offend them and pay the price.
Peter, we've seen in the virus crisis a new bureaucratic, or a new governance, I should say, animal arise, the National Cabinet of Federal and State Leaders. And basically it's worked pretty well by a consensus model which embraces disagreement, that they don't bag each other out when they differ, they just go their own ways on certain issues. Do you think this provides a new model for improving the federalism system?
I think I do. I don't want to overblow it. In a way, what is distinctive about national cabinet is just how frequently the leaders are meeting together. It's, you know, a bit like, I suppose, COAG on steroids. What I would hope would happen out of this is that at the next level, at the bureaucratic level, Michelle, this has got to happen, as I think it is happening now between our public health advisors. In other words, it would be advantageous to have a national cabinet structure, but for things to be taken forward, then you've got to have senior officials working together on a much more coherent and regular basis. What often happens, of course, beneath COAG, you have senior officials who may meet once, twice between meetings. They're not working together in a genuinely collaborative way. If this national cabinet model is going to work, it needs to start to be reflected in public services, and with Commonwealth, state and territory public services being willing to assign senior public servants to work on this 5 days a week, not 1 day every 6 weeks.
So it would be worth keeping, you think?
I think you could really build upon this model. Yes, I do, Michelle.
So could I put a final question to you both? If you could do one single thing to change the public service, what would it be? Renee, could you start?
I'd make sure that people get experience across both the policy and the service delivery ends of the spectrum before they get promoted too far up, so that wherever they end up, they'll understand that the delivery of outcomes for citizens is going to involve a breadth of skills and knowledge that they won't get if they just stay in one place.
Last word to you, Peter.
I would hope that public servants could start to realise the role they play, not just in developing policy or developing legislation or collecting revenues or delivering services, but that increasingly they saw the central role of public services in terms of the sustenance of democratic governance at a time in which it is under significant attack. And to be able to see public servants as at the dead centre and remaining at the dead centre of creating beneficial public impact. If we could get that sense amongst public servants and convey that to governments on the one hand, parliaments, and to the public on the other hand, it would be a huge step forward.
A great thought to end with. Thank you so much to both Rennie and Peter for such a thought-provoking and future-focused conversation. And many thanks to the production team at Content Group as well for their wonderful support for this podcast series. In our next podcast, we will be joined by Jen Gaskell, Jerry Stoker and Will Jennings from the TrustGov project in the UK for a conversation on COVID-19 and why the UK government is losing public trust. Goodbye for now.